And good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon, depending upon the case may be where you are on this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition, live, of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn, when all the things we used to talk about in the wee hours of the morning as we were twittering back and forth to Art Bell and George and all the other imitators now have kind of soaked into the consciousness of the entire planet 24/7. If anybody tries to tell you that this time is just normal, that things are just going along the way they've always been going along, that the news you see and the rumors and the Twitter accounts and the, you know, Twilights and the, I forget all the different, you know, private blogs and chats that are out there. If they try to tell you that's all normal, no, it is not. We are in a time of extraordinary change. What Art kind of, you know, very euphemistically called some years ago, the quickening. Meaning, I believe, if I remember how he defined it, that things would happen faster and faster. But I don't think that he really got a handle on the tenor and the tone and the quality of things changing so radically. I mean, have you heard of this professor at some Florida university? I hope it's not Florida State, who has actually proposed a revision of the Constitution where the First and Second Amendment are radically abridged and freedom of the press is curtailed. I mean, people are nuts out there. They're nuts. They're absolutely nuts. And I'm, you know, of the opinion that a lot of it is coming from, shall we say, external sources. And that's a very long conversation. Sometime after Christmas, I think it might work out for New Year's night. We're going to, I believe, have a show about these changes based on some very interesting interpretation of the Mayan calendar, the Mayan long count, and Mayan elders. And that's going to be really intriguing. I just kind of got wind of this afternoon, and I've set in motion some procedures to try to get to this person, to get him on the show. Someone who's done a lot of very interesting work, and I liked what I read, so we will see if, in fact, that can take place. I will obviously let you know as we get closer, like by next weekend we should know. Tonight we have a very special guest, someone that I've wanted to talk to about a whole bunch of this stuff that we're currently immersed in for quite some time, and the schedule's all worked out, and he is safely ensconced in his Brooklyn apartment. And we will be talking to him momentarily. But I want to start, as we start every evening, with some news. First of all, if you are new to the show, you want to go to theothersideofmidnight.com. That's our URL, theothersideofmidnight.com. And when you click on that, you will find a banner at the top of the page. Tonight's banner says, Webb Space Telescope, the coming astrophysical / ET revolution. And my guest there, Dr. Greg Matloff. We'll get to Greg momentarily, but let's when you get to that page, click on that banner that will take you to the guest page. Click on my items, Richard, under there. That takes you to my section of Radio with Pictures. Item number one, we're leaving again tonight with La Palma. The good news is that La Palma appears to be calming down. As of this afternoon, this situation appears to be calming. In fact, for 3 days, quoting from the article, no eruptive activity has taken place. The likelihood that the eruption is actually over is clearly increasing. The cone, that's the volcano itself, only shows mild degassing and no lava flows are active anymore. Official confirmation when the eruption is declared over will likely need to wait a bit longer. Some doubt remains as to the significance of the continuing activity, although of low energy and overall on a decreasing trend, it remains significant and could indicate that magma at depth is still able to pressurize and fracture rocks and create intrusions that might eventually allow it to rise further. However, this is far from certain. It could also be adjustments of the system triggered by the massive shifts of masses that has occurred during the eruption. In the latter case, the quake should slowly die out, and during the past 24 hours, there were three quakes of magnitude 3.3, 3.5, at about 35 to 36 kilometers depth, in addition to many smaller quakes at a higher altitude, closer to the ground level. Anyway, that's good news because, as you know, the worst-case scenario for La Palma is really a bad hair day, so we do not want that to happen. Again, put this link on your phone. Pay attention to alerts. If there's major earthquake activity, you want to have a go bag packed and you want to leave Dodge, particularly if you're along the oceans rimming the North Atlantic Basin or even in the Caribbean or in South America, because the worst case scenario for La Palma, applicable to the 2001 geophysical model which looked at this, is not good. And fortunately, according to these trend curves, the probability is decreasing. Item number two. Tonight, just before airtime, about 2 hours ago, the Japanese billionaire, the space tourist, the companion and colleague and cohort of Elon Musk, who was going to take eight people around the moon in one of these Starship spacecraft that Musk is busily building there along the Gulf Coast in Texas, Yusaku Maezawa and his co-pilot and the Russian commander of the mission returned in a Soyuz safely to Kazakhstan, the plateau, the plains of Kazakhstan, about 2 hours ago this evening. That's important because Maezawa had to kind of get some space time under his belt to be part of the next extraordinary adventure, which is to go in a spacecraft, in the Starship, Musk's amazing next-generation human spacecraft, on a journey in 2023. I mean, that's just, like months away, around the moon. And, of course, that's important and interesting and critical and every other superlative I can think of tonight to say, because, of course, last night, as you know, as part of our Oumuamua test experiment series before the big events next weekend, Christmas weekend, we broadcast about 15 minutes of coded information to the moon, and we got answers. And as David Sarita outlined last night, two sets of those answers involved A, the speed of light, which is kind of like the ET saying, oh, you slowpokes, you guys, you're limiting your transmissions to the speed of light. Oh, isn't that droll? Isn't that cute? Isn't that fun? Because obviously, and that's a very long discussion that we've had on previous weeks, so we will not go into it in depth tonight. That's not the final speed limits of the universe, Einstein obsessives notwithstanding. I mean, Michelson-Morley did not say there is no ether, and it has been incredibly misinterpreted over the years by the mainstream. My opinion is this is by design, this is deliberate, because a different set of physics opened up such doorways that certain political structures do not want that kind of freedom. And if you think that science can be abrogated, yeah, all you do is control the journals, and that controls what gets published. And if it isn't published in a journal, it doesn't exist for 99.99% of the mainstream. Fortunately, the guy we're going to talk to tonight, my friend Greg Matloff, is not part of that establishment. He's a real scientist. He can think outside the box. He has some extraordinarily original, innovative ideas about consciousness in the galaxy, in the universe, and we're going to get to those. In fact, we're going to talk about this extraordinary revolution that's going to be ushered in about 6 months with the cross fingers, cross toes, cross everything, successful launch of the James Webb Space Telescope on Christmas Eve. And I'm really feeling very good about this. And that, of course, has zero scientific merit. It's just that there's so much invested in Webb. And they've spent so many dollars, like $9 billion over budget to make sure that a myriad of little latches and springs and relays and bearings and all the incredibly complicated machinery required to remotely, like 1.5 million miles behind the Earth, away from the sun at the L2 point, all that remote control computerized operation to unfold and lock the mirror into place, which is really an assemblage of, I think it's 18 hexagonal mirrors that all have to fit together to kind of create this enormous 21-foot-wide primary mirror for the telescope. It's not one big, you know, parabolic thing of glass. It's 18 separate hexagons that all fit into place, and then they're tweaked with little motors, and lasers are looking, and spine guide sensors are monitoring diffraction patterns. And I mean, this is why it's going to take them 6 months to tweak and tune and tickle, like with a feather, that's a metaphor, the precision that is needed to turn this into the most extraordinary, most powerful scientific instrument. I know physicists with CERN are unhappy at that phrase, that has ever been created by humankind. So tonight with my friend Greg, we're going to go through the extraordinary ways in which James Webb, the telescope, can revolutionize, already revolutionized landscape in space, in the cosmos, in astrophysics, because of Hubble, which has lasted so much longer because of the ability of astronauts to visit it. I mean, there's no real practical way with the current state of the art of spaceflight to get to Hubble and fix anything unless you want to invoke, specters of the secret space program. But we won't go there tonight. So Hubble will be on its own. It will take them about 6 months to get it all tuned up, aligned precisely, carefully, redundantly. And then the fun begins. So without further ado, let me introduce the guy to you tonight who is going to take us through this extraordinary journey as to what Webb might unfold in terms of some of the major outstanding mysteries of astrophysics and astronomy. Not, of course, withstanding the completely unknown, bonkers, out-of-the-box surprises that the history of astronomy has shown us, that every major step forward in capability or size or function of major observatories has brought within the ken of human spirit and consciousness. In other words, there will be surprises. Some of them we're anticipating, and some of them will be totally off the wall, and there'll be incredible food fights over, are they real? Are they, you know, impressions from longstanding prejudices, or have we entered a really interesting new paradigm? I'm betting on the latter. Dr. Gregory L. Matloff, Emeritus Associate and Adjunct Associate Professor of Physics at New York City College of Technology, has coordinated the astronomy program at that institution, has consulted for the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center, is a fellow of the British Interplanetary Society, is a Hayden Associate at the American Museum of Natural History, oh, my old stomping grounds, and is a corresponding member of the International Academy of Astronautics. Greg's pioneering research in solar sail technology has been utilized by NASA in plans for extrasolar probes and in consideration of technologies to divert Earth-threatening asteroids. I guess we're going to talk about the DART mission tonight. He served as a guest professor at the University of Siena in Italy in 1994, has chaired many technical sessions, and was honored by NYCCT as scholar on campus during the 2008 to 2009 academic year. In 1998, Greg was a winner of a SETI competition sponsored by the National Academy of Discovery Science. He has authored or co-authored more than 100 research papers and 9 books, which have been cited about 400 times in the literature. One of those books, The Starflight Handbook, published by Wiley in New York in 89, was co-authored with MIT science writer Dr. Eugene Mayle. I've got that book, and Gene was a dear friend of mine. My gosh. and helped establish interstellar propulsion studies as a subdivision of applied physics. Anyway, there's a lot more you can read on the other side of midnight, so just scroll down to his bio. Without further ado, Greg, come on down.
Good morning, or good evening, or good afternoon, whatever it is.
See, that fits all. One size of that fits all. Yeah. Well, you're actually snuggled up there in Brooklyn, I believe, right?
Right. It's shortly after midnight, which is proper for beyond midnight. And I just should update that I've been now cited more than 800 times, because that's an older edition. I'm an adjunct and emeritus full professor, and I also am an advisor to Breakthrough Starshot. So that's where I know Avi Loeb, who I'm sure we'll talk about.
I'm sure we will, yes.
So, a little bit of an update.
Dealer's choice.
It's great to be here.
Dealer's choice, where do you want to begin? We have such an incredible fertile field. We only got 3 hours, so where would you like to begin?
We could begin with a little review of, I guess, we could sort of talk a little bit about the history of observational astronomy and how every little thing has created a major revolution in human thought.
Yeah, I think the lawyers call this laying foundation, and that's probably a great place, because a lot of our listeners are not astronomers. Some of them are amateur astronomers, but giving people a foundation to know why Webb is such a potential huge revolution, I think is very important. So let us begin there.
Okay. Well, one thing I always do with my students, be it in person where I used to have students, or more recently online with a Zoom derivative called Blackboard, where I have students in their homes, of course, because of COVID, is you talk about Galileo Galilei. Galileo, in the around 1600, is an amazing figure in astronomy. He learned, first of all, early on, to get around the establishment, which the global establishment, at least in the West then, was the Roman Catholic Church. And he realized unless he was very, very careful, he was going to end up in a very hot place. And I don't mean hell. Mm. I mean burned as Giordano Bruno had been burned at a stake in Rome. And he learned before anything else in astronomy that there was an obscure optical firm in, I believe, in Amsterdam. And somebody there had discovered by putting two appropriately ground lenses, one in front of the other, my God, it gave you a magnified image. So he realized what he could do with this. But before he did anything astronomical, he did something for the military-industrial complex.
Of course.
In the city-state of Venice. And he had this validated. There is a painting somewhere, and I think Titian did it, but it might be one of the other old masters, of Galileo presenting a spyglass to the Venetian Navy and basically saying, you'll be able to see the Ottoman Turks, your arch enemies, before they see you. And there was about to be a battle. It was one every generation for control of the Mediterranean. And the Christian armies blew the Ottomans out of the water. And for this, Galileo became a hero of Christendom, and he was off and running. He knew about the Copernican theory. And the Copernican theory is not really... I mean, Copernicus develops it. He's considered in the books to be the originator of the heliocentric or sun-centered solar system. He's not the originator. It goes back to Greek times, probably at least 200-300 BC. Excuse me. And what he does is he says, okay, maybe I can validate some of this. He looks at the moon. And he points out in his publications that Aristotle and others said the moon is a perfectly flat surface. It reflects the Earth. But if it's so flat, why does it have craters, mountains, flat, relatively flat areas, which are called, which we call mare or seas? We now know from Apollo and other explorations that they are extinct, very large lava flows. What, you know? So that was one thing. Then he looks at the planet Venus, and he notices that Venus has phases. And because of that, you know, that supports heliocentric thinking. Then he looks at Jupiter, and he sees that Jupiter has four satellites, large satellites we call today. He called them small satellites. And the smallest of them is about the size of our moon. The biggest is bigger than the planet Mercury. So they're not small satellites. But they demonstrated that Jupiter is like a miniature solar system. He publishes all of this knowing he's going to get in trouble. But he also realizes anybody could put two lenses together and see this. So he has his trouble with the Pope. He recants, but it's too late for the prevailing worldview because too many people can go out, get two lenses. People are grinding lenses, of course, for use in spectacles. You can get these all over the place then. Put them together, put them in a tube, and view what's going on in the heavens. And it's an amazing thing. And since then, every time there's been an advance in telescope technology, it has brought in marvelous things. What happens, the generation after him, Isaac Newton, comes up with the concept of a reflecting telescope. You can probably, he reasons that you can do everything with an appropriately curved mirror that you can do with a series of lenses, and you can reduce chromatic or optical effects. And this leads, century after that or so, to the Herschel family, who really begin the systematic observation of deep sky objects and recording what they are. They don't know what they are yet, but they record their positions, how they look in the fairly large telescopes. I believe their largest was 48 and 72 inches aperture, which is pretty good. So, you know, this was a major achievement. And then people realize, you know, as photography, astrophotography is developing after the U.S. Civil War, what happens if you can somehow attach a camera to a telescope? It would be hard to do that to Herschel's telescope because with Newtonian reflectors, the eyepiece is on the side. You can view through it, but to hang a large camera from it would be very difficult. But shortly after Newton, there was an obscure Dominican monk. His name is Cassegrain. And he said, one scientific paper this guy published, and he basically said, what if we could grind a secondary mirror for a reflecting telescope that had curvature to it? Then we could bounce the light back to a hole in the primary mirror, and we could view it. The eyepiece could be in the back of the telescope. You could view much more conveniently. And that's where we get Cassegrain, Schmidt-Maksutov, Coday, all the different variations. And this allowed people to have photographs of the heavens. And you could buy these in atlases and in textbooks. And all of, and people, of course, today routinely do this on their own. There are many, many amateurs. If you go onto any of the photographic databases on the web, you can see many people publish today their astronomical photographs all over the place, both electronically and in print. So, of course, the telescopes of this type began to grow in a larger and larger fashion. In 1948, the then largest telescope in the world was a Cassegrain on Mount Palomar, which, of course, is the 200-inch telescope.
The Big Eye, as they called it.
The Big Eye. And this inspired a number of people to say, what would happen if you could put this in space? And one famous astronomer whose name I should remember, but shortly after 12, the name is eluding me. Maybe it's a senior moment. Who knows?
I remember he was at Princeton. I know he was at Princeton.
Yes, a very well-known person suggested do something similar to the 200-inch Palomar telescope. Put it in space. You could do marvelous things with it. A person who jumped on this idea and publicized it inside what was going to become NASA was the first American woman astronomer at NASA of note, Nancy Roman, who I had the honor of meeting once. And I believe Nancy is going to have a telescope named after her very soon in space.
Yes, she is. And I actually worked when I was a consultant and got it. I worked with Nancy. She was brilliant.
Oh, she was wonderful. Well, she did something for me once that was wonderful. When I started getting interested in the fact that maybe you could use a telescope like Hubble to view extrasolar planets, I was with Al Finley at a talk she was giving at the NASA Institute for Space Studies in Uptown New York, 112th and Broadway. It's a small division of Goddard, NASA Goddard Institute of Space Studies. And she was talking about putting up an occulting disk, as I think would be done. I don't think they're going to do it. I know they won't do it with Webb, but they might do it with the Nancy Roman Space Telescope. And I said, is there any possibility that we could do this with a celestial object? And she said, we could do it with the rim of the moon.
Mm.
So Al Finley and I were off and running, and we published a number of very early papers on ways of using Hubble to image what was going to become Hubble to image extrasolar planets. And they learned how to do this without an occulter. And I believe of the many planets that have been discovered, a handful were actually imaged with Hubble. And of course, Hubble has an aperture of about 100 inches or 250 centimeters. I think it's 98 inches, actually. It is sort of limited, and right now it's getting kind of old. I know they've had to turn off a number of instruments. It's already gone. It's doubled or tripled its expected lifespan. It has become the icon of the astronomer. So right now, you know, I expect wonderful things with James Webb. I really hope it works. There are so many ways it could fail.
Oh, my God, yes.
And they had something like 330 single-point failure possibilities. And then the NASA team says they've been able to get around these. I'm very happy that Elon Musk has Dragons, and he can always put a Dragon on top of a Falcon Heavy and send the crew out to the Lagrange point, some Lagrange point, if necessary.
To say nothing of the Starship.
The Starship could go out and have a major party around this thing, certainly.
By the way, the guy we're trying to remember, Lyman Spitzer.
Very good. Excellent. Did you look him up?
Of course I looked him up. We're in the Internet age.
Great. Great. Fabulous. I never met Spitzer, but I know he was a genius.
Yep.
And I hope I forget how long he lived, but I hope he got to see Hubble.
Well, he certainly got to he got to see the Orbiting Astronomical Observatory. And when I was at Goddard, I was commissioned to write a book on the evolution of the space telescope from the first OAO to Copernicus to IUE, which was the International Ultraviolet Explorer. So that's why that name Spitzer is so embarrassing. I forgot his name. So.
Me too.
You're into
interesting.
Okay.
Okay.
A little warning always helps. Okay, say what,
okay,
Greg?
Great.
Let's pause. My guest this morning is Greg Matloff, and we're having a remarkable conversation about something really amazing and dear and near to my heart, which is the coming stunning astrophysical revolution that the Webb Space Telescope, to be launched in less than a week now on Christmas Eve on that incredible hyperdimensional square. You think that factored into their decision to delay the launch to the 24th? Who knows? Anyway, we're going to talk about the revolution that Webb is going to introduce if it can unfold properly all by itself 1.5 million miles away. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return to a night of cosmic revolution.
The only reason they've done that is because they know and have openly admitted that it's unenforceable. So if they kept everyone locked down over Christmas, they know that everyone's going to ignore it because you're going to go and see your family at Christmas. Of course you are. And they know that you've got 65 million people in the UK. You can't police 65 million people going to each other's houses for Christmas. You can't do it. There's not enough police officers. So what they've done to try and keep some kind of, you know, appearance of power is give us those days. So it's like, I know you're going around each other's houses, but we let you do it because that's better than keeping us locked down, us all doing it anyway, and them openly showing their weakness, which they have. They can't enforce it, and the police chief constable has said as much, that it's unenforceable. And so that's what I think people need to realize, is that all these music venues could open, all these theaters could open, all these restaurants could open, all these bars could open, as long as they all opened. Because then it's unenforceable. Hello everyone, my name's Gareth Ike. It's been a pleasure to talk on the other side of the news. Fantastic conversation with Kinthea, Timothy and Annetta. And I wish you all the best with a fantastic podcast. Cross my aging arm, body lying on the
with my breaking heart, make my stand right here. Action over hope. Make my stand right here. Action over hope. Action. Show your face round here. For his master power, led to hate and fear. Cross my aching heart, body lies made clear. Break my breaking heart. Make my stand right here. For action over hope. Make my stand right here.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night. It is the 19th of December. About a week away, less than Christmas. Certainly a week away, less than Christmas Eve, which NASA has now chosen to launch this incredibly overdue, it's over 10 years late, incredibly complicated, incredibly hyper-expensive, $9 billion spent to try to make this thing work all by itself over 1.5 million miles away as it unfolds, unwinds, locks mirrors and mylar and struts and springs and gears and all kinds of complicated mechanical Rube Goldbergian type devices into place to basically insulate it from the sun, to hide it in the shadow, so it will live just above absolute zero. Now, why do they want to keep it so cold, Greg? Let's kind of hit this one on the head, okay?
Okay, I think the reason for that is you want to be able to not have too much thermal expansion going on. One thing with Hubble, of course, Hubble was orbiting the Earth. So on occasion, the temperature would go probably pretty close to absolute zero when it's on the night side, and probably well above 100 degrees Celsius when it's on the day side. So, you know, you had to have certain, you have to allow a bit of time there on every orbit for there to be thermal equilibrium, which must have been very interesting in some cases, because when they did the deep field and the ultra-deep field, looking very far out in the cosmos to count galaxies, what they had to do was basically keep it focused on one, keep the telescope, keep Hubble focused on one tiny segment of the sky, something less than half a degree across, for I think 90 days. So they probably had to time this very, very, very carefully. Now, where this telescope will be, it's going to be in a situation where it can be kept very, very cold all the time, because it's not orbiting the Earth. It's in a gravitationally stable position between the Earth and the Sun. So as long as you have a sun shield, which it
actually
does
have. Actually, I think it's on the opposite side. It's away from the Earth, you know, farther from the Sun.
Okay.
A million, it's at the L2 point.
Right, I think you're right, not the L1 point.
And the really interesting part, the really, if I want to be very punny, cool part is, the one of the incredible complexities is they're unfolding this multiple layers of mylar, aluminized plastic, about the size of a tennis court, that the telescope will hide behind, multi-layered. I think it's
right.
Five layers. And of course, basically the transmission of heat in space is through electromagnetic radiation. You don't have convection, you don't have conduction. So by hiding it behind these five layers of super insulation, the size of a tennis court, imagine how big a tennis court is. And this all has to be unfolded, unwrinkled, all by computer, by control of little motors and stepping motors and, you know, struts and bars and springs. I mean, it's a nightmare. And to imagine they can actually do this successfully. So, yeah, it's really good that Musk has a spacecraft capable of going, and like we did with the shuttle and Hubble, they can go out someday if they need to and literally have an astronaut help unfold the damn thing.
Right. It's a great backup. Incidentally, before the break, when you were mentioning OAO, I almost cracked up because my first job at Colesman Instrument Corporation and then at Grumman in Long Island, Queens, New York, and Nassau County, New York, was as photometric engineer on OAO number 2 and number 3.
Oh my!
I was one of the people in charge with calibrating the star trackers, and my two first papers, both in applied optics, were on taking observatory measurements in the UBVRI system, where you put a filter in front of your telescope to look at the stars, at bright stars in only selected colors, and how to come out with this information and derive star catalogs tailored to the spectral response of your particular, of the photoelectric device on your particular star tracker. And I had a lot of fun with this. One thing we used to do is we would go out and we had a Pritchard photometer. Since you worked on this, you may have seen the Pritchards. They were wonderful devices. They were what we would use to calibrate the star trackers. I would take it out at night. Sometimes we would point it at Vega, which was one of the calibration star. Calibrate, and then we would have the device calibrated, And then we would use it with the star tracker. So it was a, you know, pointed to the simulated star that would basically be used to calibrate the star tracker. And it was a lot of fun. It was very, very nice. It was a great experience. And I almost was sued because I came out of Queens College and I knew all the, you know, we had had great hands-on experience in the optics labs. And I go into one of the facilities at Colesman and I'm busy setting up the experiment. And the technicians are looking at me and they're getting red in the face and red in the face. And finally, one of them looked at me and said, it's a good thing it's your first job and you're 20 years old because you have to know something right now. Otherwise, you would have a union grievance. Engineers don't touch things. They work with their minds. Technicians put things together. You tell us.
Oh, my God. That so reminds me of my first experience at CBS. Because I remember I was brought down as this young, not dry behind the ears, 23-year-old. To advise Walter Cronkite, Mr. Space, you know, we're going to the moon. And we're orbiting the moon on Christmas Eve, remember, Apollo 8. And yes. I heard over the intercom, you know, where's Mr. Hoagland? Cronkite needs him. So I rush out on the floor of the studio, and I got the whole bunch of documents and whatever. And I got three different unions furious at me because they were supposed to carry my paperwork. All I was supposed to do is walk up to the desk.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was nuts, you know. Yes, unions.
It's so funny.
Now, let me ask you a question, very interesting question, which probably the only two people on the planet listening to us tonight will know the answer to this, you and me. What made the Orbiting Astronomical Observatory, which was a predecessor to Hubble, it was the first NASA space telescope. It was, I had a 36-inch mirror, I believe, you know, Cassegrain telescope. What made it unique in the history of telescopes, either on Earth or in space? Totally unique.
Okay. It turns out that the Earth's atmosphere is only partially transmissive to electromagnetic radiation from the sun. It turns out that most, except for the visual band of the spectrum and some of the radio band, nothing passes through. So what people realized early on is we have to begin to look at things in different ranges of the spectrum. And as I recall, decades later, the OAO was the first ultraviolet telescope. Other than there was one on, I believe, stratospheric balloons in the late 1950s.
It was called Stratoscope, and it was lifted up into the stratosphere about 120,000 feet by a huge Perkin-Elmer polyethylene balloon on a stabilized platform.
This was a test, and it demonstrated that, my gosh, you can see a lot in the ultraviolet if you can get above the lower atmosphere. And this was the first instrument to do that. There have been others.
Actually, it turns out, Greg, it was not. The first group, the first American group to do astronomy in space that used an ultraviolet sensor, you know, this was film, and optics, quartz optics, so it would pass ultraviolet light, was in fact the CIA. In Project Corona. And the reason I know this is because they took bizarre pictures of the moon from Earth orbit. And there's all kinds of astonishing detail, which of course is the ancient structures on the moon that I talk about a great deal, that the CIA knew they were there and they picked the ultraviolet because of the scattering properties of the glass versus the surface. But they were the first government institutions, a spy agency, to loft, in essence, an ultraviolet telescope into space to do an astronomy observation.
Interesting.
And I can send you the pictures. They're amazing. Okay. I wasn't actually thinking in terms of the function of OAO. I was thinking of more like engineering. The engineering thing that made it so unique was it's the only telescope that I can remember. I've looked and looked and looked, either on Earth or in space, that literally was covered, the tube was covered with a layer of porcelain, like a bathtub. And it was for thermal control. They literally put an orbiting bathtub into space with a camera and lens system in it and mirror, and that was OAO. The outer covering was porcelain. See the things you learn when you write a book about NASA stuff?
It is. It's fabulous. It's fabulous.
Anyway, so...
I did not know that. Yes.
Well, now you do. And you'll never be able to unlearn it, all right? So, all right. So we've got these series of revolutions. Talk about big telescopes on Earth in history and the revolutions that each additional capability ushered into in terms of the general paradigm of who the hell are we and what are we doing in this place?
Okay. In about the year 1900, people were quite certain that there was only one galaxy. That was the universe. And it was centered on pretty close to where the sun is. And we were in the middle of this. And it reached out maybe 60 or 70,000 light years. And then along came the predecessor to Hubble, which is called the Mount Wilson Telescope, which has an aperture. It still exists, although it can't see very much in Los Angeles skies now, an aperture of about 100 inches or 250 centimeters.
Yeah, it's called the Hooker Telescope because the guy who paid for it was an industrialist in the trolley business, I think, named Hooker.
Yeah, I always remembered if he was related to a Union general in the Civil War whose name was also but we have to check that. We'd have to check that. But anyway,
could be the same family.
It very possibly is. There was a very gifted observer, a guy who has a very famous name. His name, of course, is Hubble. And what he did is he used this telescope to begin looking at the spectra of some of the fuzzy objects that the Herschel family had discovered and before them, Messier, a century before that, had looked at. And they thought that these were just clouds in the sky. But all of a sudden, they realized, as they looked at the Doppler shift, they looked at the fact that the spectral lines are signatures of various elements. But their position in the spectra can change if something's moving away from us. They were able to demonstrate that these fuzzy objects were moving away.
Yeah, the familiar Doppler, the so-called Doppler shift.
The Doppler effect. And what happened is as he looked further and further out, they were moving faster. So Hubble concluded in the 1920s that the universe was expanding. And this initially freaked out Albert Einstein, because Albert Einstein, who was in many ways a follower of Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza, people say Albert Einstein was an atheist physicist. That's nonsense. He was not an atheist. What he believed is that consciousness, that deity, in fact, was combined with the universe. They were the same thing. And he figured that the universe, therefore, you're looking at the body of God. It's stable. And general relativity initially did not believe that the universe could be expanding. And it turned out that there was a Roman Catholic priest at the Vatican Observatory, his name, Lemaître. Lemaître and also a Jewish guy named Friedman, who did this independently, who demonstrated that relativity, general relativity, for a perfectly stable universe would not work. It would be on the knife edge. You either have to have a contraction.
More like a razor blade.
A razor blade. So what Einstein did is he threw in a fudge factor called the cosmological constant, thinking he didn't like doing this because this is his perfect work. And of course, the cosmological constant has come back to us today to explain the fact that the universe's expansion seems to be speeding up. So it's amazing how these ideas work and develop. And then another guy who did something And this is a very interesting telescope. Less than a decade after this, a Percival Lowell had been he came from a railroad family in the U.S., and he decided to end his life building a private observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, and using this observatory to map the canals of Mars, which you now know today were illusory. But that's still okay because he had the telescope, he had the reputation, and people learned around 1910, 1920, that there were slight perturbations to the orbit of Neptune, and they hypothesized there would be Planet X out there. So Lowell hired a bright young guy who only had a bachelor's degree.
From Kansas, Dorothy.
And he was right, exactly, from Kansas. He was a farm kid.
Yep.
But he was one of those
who built his own 6-inch reflecting telescope.
Yeah, in the farm. And he comes in, Clyde Tombaugh, and using a blink comparator, when you basically on this telescope, you take, I used a blink comparator in my 1 year at Wesleyan. In 1969, late 69 through 70, it's a wonderful device. One, you take two pictures a day apart of the same segment of the sky. One is a photographic positive, one's a photographic negative. Then you look at them together at the same time. You adjust the lights so the light is the same for both of them. And if there is a streak, something's moving. And he did this with extreme accuracy, and he discovered the dwarf planet Pluto. Of course, we didn't know it was a dwarf planet then. It was devices like Hubble and the very large terrestrial telescopes, which have originated about the time that Hubble did, that demonstrated that what we thought was a single object, Pluto, was really two, Pluto and its moon Charon. And Pluto is actually an object which is smaller, considerably smaller than our moon. But because of the second object orbiting at Charon, we know that it is it appeared to be one Earth-sized object to people like the Tombaugh and other people who checked him out. So this has been remarkable. And then along comes the use of Hubble and these other large terrestrial telescopes, and people start wondering about, can we actually detect extra planets circling other stars? And some people say they wasted their lives. It's a sad story. Peter van de Kamp and Sarah Lippincott were astronomers at Sproul Observatory in Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, in the Appalachian Mountains. And what they did was they spent 30 years looking at the second nearest star, Barnard Star, as it streaks across the sky. It's the fastest moving, highest pop of motion star in the cosmos.
It's a little red dwarf, about one tenth the mass of the sun. And maybe ten thousandth its brightness.
And they figured if there was a planet there, a large planet, it might cause a little wiggle. And lo and behold, they discovered the wiggle, and they published their data. And then other people, years later, they figured, of course, they had to validate this. So They didn't have an observing sequence like that at any one institution. They said, let's combine plates from Wesleyan, where I had been, the Yale Observatory in New Haven, from probably 5 or 6 other institutions. This was done by Gatewood and Eichhorn, one of whom was in Florida, one I think in Georgia, and they found no planet. And they went back and they found what had happened is in the middle of the observation run by Sarah and Peter, the telescope had been renovated and the lens had been put in, the primary lens had been put in slightly differently. And this, of course, caused the apparent effect And of course, it must have been heartbreaking. But what it did is it turned on other people. And in 1992, I had the opportunity of predicting what was going to happen. But at that point, because of the Apollo layoffs and everything that followed it, I was working as a purely adjunct professor. I wasn't full-time anywhere. I didn't have tenure. And I was consulting. And as such, I wasn't going to challenge the establishment. I had published with Gene the Starflight Handbook, and I get a call. Phone calls, and somebody says, "Well, hello, this is Greg Matloff." And I say, "Yep. I would like you to help me as a consultant, an unpaid consultant on a science fiction novel. Would you be willing to do it?" And I said, "Well, yeah, but I have to know your name." And he said, "My name is Buzz Aldrin."
Oh, my God.
And I said, "Wait a minute. You know, a lot of people can say that. It may not be true. I need proof." He said, "Here is a phone number. Call this phone number. You're going to go through a appropriate switchboard. They will connect with me." It was Buzz.
Wow.
And Buzz is an amazing person. When I was doing this work, what he really wanted me to do, this was for a book he did with John Barnes called Encounter with Tiber. He liked the work I had done on solar sail starships, photonic starships. And he wanted me to design two. And it was amazing to be with Buzz because we met him.
Can I ask you an embarrassing question?
Yeah.
Why didn't he want to pay you?
I think this is because he didn't pay any of his consultants. He figured the celebrity would be enough. He did take us out to eat, though. I learned the power of celebrity in this society. He took me and my wife. He was with his second wife, Lois, at the time.
Right.
They took us out to the Plaza Hotel, major hotel in New York. We go into the Palm Room, and other people start pointing at him. And he gets upset. He looks at a waiter who says, "You see that room over there? I want that opened for me and my guests. And by the way, my name is Buzz Aldrin." You never saw people move that quickly to get a table ready. It was remarkable. It took them about 40 seconds. I wish I had been timing it. Anyway, after I went through the analysis of the two ships that they needed, he said, "Okay, I know that you got your PhD doing planetary atmospheres. John and I need in this book, we have to have a Jupiter-like planet at one astronomical unit at Earth's distance from a sun-like star, in this case, Alpha Centauri A. Do you think the atmosphere will be stable for billions of years?" And I said, "Well, the planetologists, the orthodox planetologists..."
I tell you what, hold it there. This is a great tease. My guest this morning is Dr. Greg Matloff. You just found out first here that Buzz Aldrin hired him to be a technical consultant to his fictional novel after he came back from the moon called Encounter with Tiber. Gosh, have I got all kinds of questions. It's kind of like when I got the phone call from Cronkite's folks and they said, "We'd like to help us go to the moon." You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We'll return to Greg's fascinating story about the technical background for the star system in Buzz Aldrin's Encounter with Tiber when we return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night, December 19th, just days away from the winter solstice, when the Earth and the Sun align with the 4 million solar mass hole at the center of the galaxy. And in the hyperdimensional physics model, again measured, all kinds of very interesting things happen. What's happening here on the other side of midnight is that Greg Matloff is in the middle of a story where he is hired to be a consultant to Buzz Aldrin to design a star system for the second man to walk on the moon. Greg, the floor is yours.
Hello?
You're on.
Okay, I have to put the earbuds back in. I mean,
those are spending little earbuds, yes.
Okay, there it is. Okay, so what Buzz said is, I know you have your doctorate in basically planetary atmospheres. Here is a challenge. Go back into the theory. See if there's an equation that we can use to demonstrate, is it true that an atmosphere of a Jovian planet will evaporate if it's close to the star?
Okay, let me stop you there. Hang on. Let me stop you there, because we have to give people the proper context. This conversation took place in what, 69, 70?
No, the conversation took place in 92 or 93.
Okay,
because
the first exoplanet, 51 Pegasi, was not announced until 95. And the astronomical community en masse had no idea of a class of planets or star systems called hot Jupiters, where instead of the Jupiter-sized planet hanging out half a billion miles from the star, like Jupiter, it literally orbits inside the orbit of the planet Mercury in our solar system. So this problem of evaporation of atmospheres on Jovian planets circling closer than the Earth is not an academic one, but back then it was totally unknown. So you were at the cutting edge of a frontier calculation. Could this be a stable system?
Right, without knowing it.
Without knowing anything, yeah.
Without knowing anything. So I took him up on his dare. You do that with
adventure,
people.
Yes, yes.
You take them up on their dare.
Yes, you do.
I found a textbook, a source book, Introduction to Space Science, and the people who had collaborated on it were mentors of mine, on my, you know, people who I had worked with. There was Robert Jastrow, who had been the head of the Institute.
An old friend of mine, Bob Jastrow, yes.
Right. It was Dick Stewart, who basically hired me as my first stint as a NASA consultant on basically the Earth's atmosphere, and Ikviak Rasool. And in this book, there is an equation that they say is a heuristic equation. It is not rigorous. And it talks about the lifetime of a planetary atmosphere. It has all the parameters in it. So I took Jupiter.
Was this based on Sir James Jeans' work back in the 1920s?
It might be. I would have to go back and check the references, which it's possible that upon that.
Because I remember that he came out with the first calculations of if you had a world like the moon and it had an atmosphere, how long would it take to evaporate? If you had a planet like the Earth at the same distance, how long? In other words, he did those very pioneering calculations of, you know, escape path and mean free Boltzmann temperatures and all that stuff. So these guys must have built on Gene's original ideas to give a more sophisticated kind of arm-waving model.
It was definitely an arm-waving model. And later on, I actually had a couple of students who I was mentoring them in a science fair project at the City College, and they went back to the literature. They couldn't find a derivation. So these guys really knocked it together. But I looked at this, I went through it, and lo and behold, Buzz was right. So he thanked me, and I then said, well, should I publish this? And I gave in to fear. I said, I can't, you know, I'm a consultant. I am a non-tenured adjunct professor teaching all over the place. I really got cold feet. A year and a half after that, maybe less, Jeff Marcy at Berkeley and his colleague in Sweden, I think, Guy, whose last name I forget.
Wasn't it Switzerland? I thought it was Switzerland.
Maybe it's Switzerland. You're probably right. They began to publish about 51 Pegasus, and there were a couple of other stars. And one, I saw them do a dog and pony show at an IAU conference on the island of Capri in 1996. One would get up and say, my team has discovered this. The other one would get up right after that and say, my team has confirmed this. And they reverse roles.
Let me give you another parenthetical note here, because Keith Morgan, who's our, you know, resident engineer, used to work for a guy named Ted Koppel. And in my book, Ted Koppel's biggest decision, his team's biggest decision with Nightline, was when they decided to take the entire crew and go up to the Harvard College Observatory the night or the week of the announcement of 51 Pegasi and hang out in that observatory and to a whole half hour on the first known exoplanet and Marcy's calculations and observations and all that. They devoted a half hour of mainstream news to an obscure astronomical, amazing paradigm shift event.
Right. And it is, which is amazing. And what happened then, of course, is this really, really opened, it opened the floodgates. And the funniest thing that I experienced with it was my first year, and I think it was 2016, as an advisor to Project Starshot, I'm out at NASA Ames. We're sitting, all of us together at a table, and people are talking about taking these little tiny thin sails, sending them by lasers to Alpha Centauri, and Avi Loeb from Harvard and Pete Warden, who, I should say maybe General Pete Warden, who used to also, he directed the Star Wars program.
Well, before that, he was an Apollo astronaut, and I believe he was the command.
That's a different. I'm sorry, it's not Pete Warden. It's Pete. I forget his last name. Anyway, he became the director of NASA Ames. And
right.
I know Pete, but his name eludes me at the moment. But that's not his last name. But anyway, what they came out and said, well, I think we have to change direction a little bit because it's just been reported a very solid observation from the European team. And we're going out there for the talk about it. There is a planet in the habitable zone of Proxima Centauri, a red dwarf star. And this totally flipped us out. Mm. There was one guy there on the team and his name of French origin, his name also eluded me. He says, you know what this means? If you go to a beach and you turn a rock over, and there was a big bug under it, you're pretty sure there's going to be a lot of big bugs on that beach. And, of course, he was right. We now have found Earth-sized planets circling in the habitable zones of many, many, many stars. Well, okay, but what does it mean? What does this mean for humanity? It means a great deal, I think, because there was another space telescope that was launched in 2013. And I have been waiting for this with my work on stellar consciousness, because I don't want to get too off track now.
No, we will get to stellar consciousness in the next hour or so. Okay.
Right, but okay. But I was waiting for confirmation, which I got, of my assumptions that I put into that talk, into that field. But it discovered something else, too. This is Gaia.
This new space telescope.
It is named Gaia, and the purpose of Gaia was to get accurate observations, position and motion observations, for 1 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy.
Mm.
And it was very funny. When the data started coming in, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Denton A. Bell, and people like that, at the Hayden Planetarium, which is now the Rose Earth and Space Center, put on an event, and on the ceiling, on the dome, they showed the billion stars from Gaia. And I asked them, I said, what happens if Gaia discovers another 10 stars? And they looked at me and says, the dome will collapse. And of course, it was hysterical. But anyway.
Well, Gaia, by the way, is a successor mission to an earlier astronomy telescope called Hipparchus, in the Greek, lore history, is supposed to be the first guy that kind of democratized astronomy, made the first star maps,
right,
that kind of thing.
Right,
so this
right.
idea of very precise distances, and if you measure the distance twice per year, as the Earth orbits the sun, you get what's called parallax, meaning you get distances that are accurate. The distances most stars now are inaccurate to 10 to 15%. These satellites now with telescopes dedicated to stellar positions can get distances down to 1%. And that's an amazing revolution. Again, an astronomical new telescope technology that's given us a whole new set of windows to the universe in which we live.
Right. And people started to analyze this data. And I sent you a paper on the second data release of about a bit more than a million stars by a team at St. Petersburg in Russia, and as well as validating Perengo's list continuity that we'll talk about later, they come up with a couple of very interesting results. One, stars in the galactic vicinity of the sun, meaning out more than 1,000 light years, are in general more than a billion years older than our sun. They discover that, which is fabulous. And at about the same time...
So wait. You mean you have the sun, and we've got an age of about 4.5 billion years, but it lives in a neighborhood of much older relatives all clustered around it in this spiral arm.
Right.
Wow.
And which means, and then it becomes even more exciting because they're looking at, another group was looking at motions, at close encounters of stars to the sun. And what they do is they demonstrate that at intervals of about a few hundred thousand years, a sun-like star passes within a light year or so of the sun, which means within the comet belt. And this was exciting for both me and Jim Benford and other researchers, because what it meant is that our current The two basic interstellar travel technologies that people look at today seem to be at the verge of feasibility, some type of explosive fusion device or a hyper-thin solar sail deployed as close to the sun as you can get. And with these, you could get a human population, a small human population, to the nearest star within 1,000 years. But what if the nearest star was at one quarter of that distance, 200 years, 250 years, all of a sudden...
The lifetime of the United States.
So when you start saying, okay, most of these stars are a billion years or more older than the sun. They, many of them, come close to the sun very, very frequently. And this is, by the way, a pessimistic, because Gaia has a magnitude limitation. It doesn't do very well with the cataloging the small, low-mass red dwarf stars.
I think it's a relatively small telescope, maybe like a meter.
It is. I think it's a bit more than that, but it is small. So it really can't do too much with the red dwarfs, with the M-class stars. So there's going to be many, many more close stellar encounters now, which means if life evolves frequently, and if life in some places develops to the point of technology, if a technological civilization can overcome things like nuclear war, climate change, these are called the great filters, if it can get through that, all you need is one to colonize at these speeds, only traveling during an encounter. How long does it take to cover most of the galaxy? 35 million years.
That's
and
nothing.
Man, you know,
that's nothing.
That is absolutely nothing. So, which means if we don't find artifacts in the solar system, there is something very, very wrong with something we're talking about. Maybe life kills itself off 99.99999% of the time. Maybe we are a divine production or an accident in one out of a gazillion.
Well, of course,
one out of a gazillion cases.
As this audience knows, you know, from our work and many others we've had on the show, we have found artifacts all over the damn solar system, and NASA just hasn't told anybody yet.
Right.
All our Brookings.
So, I think, you know, this is going to become more and more evident. And
in other words, we're at the knife edge of another huge revolution,
yeah.
A paradigm shift of cataclysmic proportions, like right around the corner.
And one journal which is really getting into this in a big way right away is the International Journal of Astrobiology. They contacted me to do a special issue on a class of interstellar probes called von Neumann machines. What a von Neumann machine is, you launch it, it goes to the star, it gets there, it produces copies of itself, they fly off to other stars.
Did you ever see Arthur Clarke's sequel with Peter Hyams to 2001, 2010?
I did see that one, and that's what causes Jupiter
exactly,
to
the von Neumann
become
machines.
A star. The von Neumann machines.
Yep.
Arthur Clarke jumped on the idea. Excuse me. Anyway, they asked me to do propulsion, and I spend my time on propulsion, but I said, I want to get a little away from this and also talk about where to look. And I know that Avi Loeb with Ed Turner at Princeton and me working with Tony Martin in Britain had suggested the Kuiper Belt. Jim Benford has been talking about, is in California, in the Berkeley, I think it's more the Berkeley, not the Stanford area, but I think it's Berkeley, has been talking about the possibility of looking for this in near-Earth asteroids. They might be a good place to look for artifacts. But there was a Russian guy, and I didn't know this. They made sure that I quoted him when I revised the paper, who said, we look on the moon. And other people have said, artifacts can be quite small. We might look at something the size of the von Neumann probe, the size of our contemporary spacecraft, a few meters.
Mm-hmm.
And we might be able to detect these. We might also be able to detect larger things. So I'm looking at all this, and, you know, if it's not there, there's a problem. And I can understand the reticence of governments about this and the reticence of military establishments, because a military establishment, you know, if this is true, and if they can survive. Once again, we can design space habitats today that can be relatively self-sustaining. There's no reason why, if you have a big enough mirror, you couldn't put these things in the Kuiper Belt. There's no reason why there couldn't be civilizations very close to us.
Mm-hmm.
This completely throws away one of the arguments against UFOs being spacecraft. And that argument, there's a reasonably famous radio astronomer, I won't mention him by name because he might be embarrassed, with the SETI Institute, who regularly debunked UFO reports to say, how could so many come here so regularly?
Oh, I know who you're talking about, and my audience does too.
Who is it?
Seth Shostak. Come
That's
on.
Exactly who it is.
Yeah, of course.
I didn't want to embarrass
Seth. Seth deserves to be embarrassed, okay?
Because when you talk about this information on possible colonization of the solar system, if you have an advanced civilization that close, 30 astronomical, 40 astronomical units away, they could be doing anything they want.
It's the 800-pound gorilla story.
Yeah. And
I mean, look at it this way. The Kuiper Belt, again, we're talking mainstream astronomy here, folks, is populated by objects. We know a few of them. We actually flew by one, Ultima Thule, which was renamed. We know they're incredibly rich in organics, in carbon, in ices, in all the stuff you need to live. And the only thing that is needed, again, in the mainstream to make it work so you can set up a totally independent, self-sustaining civilization would be energy. Well, you build yourself a big enough mirror in zero gravity, you get all the damn energy from the sun you could want. And if you conquer fusion, again, mainstream thinking, you're the 800-pound gorilla. You can live off the land in the Kuiper Belt forever. And the neat part is, if you want to think about hiding is neat, with current technological telescopic technology, you'd be very hard to be detectable from Earth until Webb.
Right, and what happened when they realized that New Horizons was still alive after passing Pluto? Excuse me. This is what happened when I lectured for a long time. Thank you. What happened is they wanted to find a second destination. They knew these objects were out there. So what did they do? They enlisted thousands of astronomers, radio professional and amateur, and they used Hubble. They said, we'd have to look at a number of stars close to the trajectory of New Horizons to look for an occultation. And Hubble was able to verify this. They were able to find and pinpoint the location of a particular object 30 kilometers across the sun. And this is Ultima Thule, or what is it, MU69, I think, is its other designation. It now has a new name also, which I forget.
Yeah, me too. I liked Ultima Thule, regardless of the German connotations, because it basically gave it this ultimate frontier feel. And now it's kind of dissolved into where we can't even remember the new name. So
I know, why did they play this game? So, you know, so what I started doing is, of course, along came COVID. And like many other people, my wife and I happen to have a lovely wife. We have a beautiful house, fully renovated. I'm able to teach as an adjunct from home. Although CUNY is opening officially in another month, and I don't know if I may take the semester off because of Omicron, but I will decide that. But anyway, I had plenty of time because I wasn't doing my hour commute to the college twice a week. I wasn't going out as much. So I started doing a lot of reading.
Mm.
And one book I read, which I had located up in my shelf, was a book by an astronomer named Jacques Vallée.
Oh, I know Jacques, yeah. French.
I've never met him. I mean, he's French. I've never met him. I know his colleague, Eric Davis, who I know you know. And Eric has collaborated with Jacques. Jacques is the role model for the guy in Close Encounters
exactly,
of the Third Kind.
Exactly, exactly, yes, yes.
Who gets the music going, says, Allahs, Allahs, and it starts playing automatically, and the world ship comes down, and that's it. But anyway, he published a book called Dimensions, and Dimensions is very interesting, and it really shook me up a bit, because what he talks about is the abduction phenomenon, the UFO abduction phenomenon. Now, my experiences with the UFO abduction phenomenon means maybe it's a psychological thing. The only person I know who claims she's been abducted a lot, I'm not going to mention her name, was trained as a corporate lawyer. And she, these experiences, whatever they are, encouraged her to change careers to become a rock singer, a psychic. And periodically, she will also go back to law when she needs money. But okay, I found out.
Sounds like someone I should interview.
Well, I would have to ask her.
Yeah, of course, of course.
But anyway, when she was young, she let us both know about this last time we saw her. She was psychologically abused by her mother. Now, a few years before that, my wife, C. Bangs, who was an artist and my collaborator in many of these ventures, was in an art show in Chelsea, one of the art centers in New York, and a woman visiting the show looked at her work and said, I'm putting together something on interstellar contact, and it's going to be in a center, a former movie theater in Hoboken, New Jersey, where Frank Sinatra used to perform incidentally. And it's going to be called Culture of Contact.
Mm.
So we went there and see us hanging her work. We both noticed that all of the other art has little fetus-like creatures, gray creatures with extended heads and big eyes. We looked at each other and said, we both realized what we were in for. So I'm on a panel with a science fiction writer and a psychologist, and we're talking about UFO cases. And the two UFO cases that I had experienced were basically easy to throw out. The first one was the Apollo 13 urine dump. I was at Wesleyan at the time observing, and I set the telescope up to observe this. It was really to send a crystalline cloud, an artificial comet, through the Earth's magnetic field. And basically, the whole point of this was to see what would happen with Earth magnetism. But the phone rings, and the guy on the other end says, I'm observing a UFO 30 degrees above the southern horizon, about as bright as a second magnitude star. And I said to him, we're on it. It's a urine dump from Apollo 13. I'm looking at it now, and I can see Apollo in it. And he got very quiet and said, you are in on the conspiracy.
And he slammed the phone down.
Well, okay, so it indicated people like conspiracies. The second case was in 1990. I was back in New York. And C is working as an artist, a consulting artist for the Department of Parks and Recreation. And I am their consulting astronomer.
I tell you what, we're at the bottom of the hour. Hold it there.
Okay.
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect. Great point. My guest this morning is Dr. Greg Matloff, who is a font of fascinating stories. Gosh. And our careers and our lives and the people we know have overlapped so many ways. Fascinating. You are on the other side of midnight. We're going to get to the Webb telescope and the major revolutions that we're thinking it might introduce. But he's already introduced one that I hadn't thought of, which is Webb can see if there's somebody living in the Kuiper Belt and using energy, because if they are, they must be radiating furiously in the infrared. And Webb, a 21-foot-sized mirror, that will be as bright as a candle, 20 feet away. We can't miss them if they're there. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoglund and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to the other side of midnight, the land of extraterrestrial ghost stories tonight. Greg's telling us about an art exhibition involving UFOs and abductions and little gray beings. And then, you know, a very kind of mundane urine dump from an Apollo mission in the Earth's magnetosphere, which someone got all excited about, and oh, it's a UFO. See, the problem is that there are IFOs and UFOs, and real UFOs are much more interesting, as we have described on the show and demonstrated apropos of our first transmissions to Oumuamua on the night of December 4th, right above the antenna. Anyway, Greg, please continue.
Okay, so anyway, the second UFO... I we should really call it an IFO. Three nurses are coming home at night after the night shift from their hospital in Queens on a bus riding along Casino Boulevard. They happen to look over at Casino Park, and they notice over the lake three lights. Now, who should they call about this? Well, maybe call the police. Maybe you call air traffic control. No, they called in a professional ufologist. There are such people. This guy comes in, and he basically projects. He says, well, not really over the lake. He does something totally unscientific. He projects to the other side of the lake. So they're wrong in that respect, which means he's taking observations, and then he's cooking them, which you really can't do. He goes to the other side of the lake. He finds a few dead spots in the park, and he says this is obviously where they landed. He analyzes the dead spots, and he sees there's a strange rock there. It's an igneous rock called diorite, and it comes from Aruba. What's it doing here? And then he takes out a compass, and he sees that all of the lampposts near this area
magnetized. This rock comes from Aruba, the little island in the Caribbean?
Yes.
How do we know that?
Well, this apparently it is the major source of diorite, a major source of diorite. He was right on that because I had that checked with the geologist. But okay, so the Parks Department said it's obviously nonsense, but the local press, the Queens Press, is having a field day.
Of course.
And what they do is, and I learned this, these little newspapers, you go into the supermarket, in many cases, you find them for free in the regional newspapers, and they're supported by advertising. But if their circulation goes sky high, their advertising revenue also goes sky high.
Mm-hmm.
So they start devoting more and more time to this, and I finally go out there with a ranger, a park ranger, and we verify. First of all, we do a little research. We say, yes, they're diorite. But what is diorite used for? It's used in tennis courts. What's going on in Casino Park? The tennis courts are being renovated. So obviously, somebody is transferring dirt. Now, if you work for Parky, if you're a Parky, which I was as a consultant, you don't announce that you killed some grass. If something falls off a truck, let it be a UFO. That's obviously what happened. Dynamite that they were moving from one place to another fell off their cart.
Does this UFO guy have a name? Can we talk about him?
I believe, if I'm correct, it was Kelly. You know, you can look this up. Look up Casino Park UFO because I did the report on it. It's still on watch.
Because this kind of really shoddy investigation deserves to be outed.
Oh, it's horrible. It really is horrible, and it demolishes what should be a serious field. And I hope it's going to get more serious. But anyway, we also looked at the magnetism. He was absolutely correct. All of the lampposts near the landing site, alleged landing site, were magnetized. Then we walked through the park, and lo and behold, they're all magnetized. So obviously the UFOs come back to magnetize every night. Or
are these 19th century cast iron lampposts?
Yes, which probably have a transformer in them, which would have a magnetic field, of course.
Yeah, of course.
So to a rectifier. So we had fun with that. But then what happened is, at the conclusion of this, the local papers published one column summarizing my report, and they had given the ufologist
party pooper.
They had given him weeks and weeks and weeks of coverage. So it demonstrated to me that local press sometimes isn't going to give you real news.
Well, in the internet era, we call this clickbait. And the outrageous nonsense on YouTube, all the fake, you know, artifacts on other planets and UFOs. And I mean, the signal-to-noise ratio has gone to zero.
Exactly. And it's funny. So anyway, but in the middle of this talk, I talk about my UFO experience, and I tell them that I'm open to it. But, you know, this is what I've had. And a woman gets up and says, maybe one of you can help me. This was on a panel. I have been abducted seven times. I have produced children. When I am able to see the children, I can never take them home. I can never have proof of this. So all of us are very understanding.
What
year
was this?
We don't have an explanation.
What year?
It must have been something like 2010, 2011.
Oh, okay.
2012. This is fairly recent,
yeah,
this one.
Yeah.
You know, where the culture of contact occurred at in this former movie theater in Hoboken. And later on, I'm standing next to the psychologist in the urinal, taking a little break at the urinal. And he says to me, Greg, you handled that very well, but I want to tell you something from a psychological point of view. I run across this all the time. In many, many cases, when women are when women are abused as children, they do something with this knowledge. If they've been sexually abused by a family member who's supposed to be protecting them, they do something with it, and that's where some of these phenomena come from. And I would bet a fair amount of money that this woman was abused as a child, an adolescent. So that stuck with me. And I didn't think much more about the abduction phenomenon until last year. Then because of COVID, I've been doing a lot of reading. I've never read this much in my life. I've also been very productive in terms of research papers, some of which we'll talk about later. And I picked up a book by Jacques Vallée called Dimensions. Not dementia, dimensions, like in four or five dimensions.
Right. would you like to take a break? Would you like to take a break and take some water? Have your wife bring you some water?
I've been doing it every 30 minutes, taking a sip. But that's okay. If I need it,
you need to take more.
Thanks.
You know, as someone who speaks a lot,
doing it.
You know, I never come down to do this show without having water sitting right by me, because you'd be amazed how in 3 hours you need to drink a lot of water. And
I know that. I have it right next to me. I'm going to take a sip right now. I've left the bed.
Okay.
Delicious. Okay. I keep it, of course, next to the bed. I make sure it was filled. So anyway, what he does is he looks at the current UFO abduction phenomenon, and then he goes back through history, and he talks about fairy abductions. Now, the basic case of a fairy abduction is that somebody is out wandering, and he comes across these little people, and they ask him to join the circle, and he does that. He dances, he eats with them, and then he comes out, and years have passed. And he says, this is a correlation with the current abduction phenomenon. We're looking at the same thing. He looks at miracles. Every religion, be it Judaism, be it Christianity, be it Buddhism, be it Islam, has miracles. And the concept of a miracle is very interesting. It's an apparent local violation of physical law. He talks about Lourdes. He mentions the fact that, yes, people there, when the Virgin was talking about meeting the Virgin Mary, were noticing a suspension in time. Nobody else saw this. He mentions the fact that at a certain battle in Joshua's army, when they invade, when they leave Egypt and they're invading what is going to become Israel, it looks like the sun has stopped its motion. And what he's saying is, okay, one thing, and he doesn't come out and quote Arthur C. Clarke, but Arthur C. Clarke has a statement that Bob Forward uses.
One of my favorite laws of Arthur's, yes.
And I'm sure you know this. It says, any sufficiently advanced technology will appear to be magic.
Yep, yep. Third law.
So
third law.
He comes to this, and he also talks about the fact that just before the dawn of aviation, people start seeing airships and reporting there are airship events, large dirigibles. Of course, there's no such thing has been constructed yet. So what's going on? And what seems to be the case, according to him, is that we are being manipulated. He does not like this conclusion.
Well, do you remember did you get to read the follow-on book that he wrote called Messengers of Deception, which is my favorite?
I have not read that one.
Read that one, because I think that's what's also going on. We are being manipulated. And then there's another author you should check in with. His name is Charles Fort. Does that name
ring
a bell?
Yes, I read him as a youngster. And what Fort did is he found anomalous events from all over the world,
yep,
going back at least to the year, to the 19th century. And I think he published this in the 1920s or 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically the same thing. And he said something, are we property?
Yeah, exactly.
And
that's his key line, are we property?
So, you know, then along comes our dear friend Avi Loeb. And when Oumuamua, and I really wish we could call it Rama, came through the solar system,
You need more water. You need more water. Take your time.
I will take it.
Come on. Take the time.
Clear my throat. I'm all right. Okay. What he does is, I'm going to take a sip. You're correct.
Take more than a
sip.
We have plenty of time.
I've run out of water.
I can fill. I can whistle, you know, Dixie. I can do all kinds of things. I can play the five tones from Close Encounters.
That's very good. I wish I could do that. Anyway, to see the way that he's been able to shoot down the people who've critiqued him. And some of the arguments are ridiculous. One guy publishes something in the physics archive saying it can't possibly be an alien space probe because it has been flying for hundreds of thousands of years. And I look at that and say, what nonsense. If it came locally, if it came from the Kuiper Belt, it's been flying for maybe 5 years, if that long. Forgive me a break.
Well, but
you
even
no
if it's
proof.
Been flying for a very long time, remember,
It's like
there
it's
was
AI.
There was a concept called a Bracewell probe. We now know we can see real AI on the horizon. We're not quite there yet, but we're almost there. So you put these together with materials developments, we could create something. Remember, the current science says that Oumuamua was much smaller probably than initial estimates based on the light curve, and it appeared to be highly reflective because Spitzer, another infrared telescope, predecessor of Webb, found no infrared emission or re-emission, meaning it has to be smaller than a certain size. So you put all the data together, it's on the order of maybe an aircraft carrier tumbling.
Yeah, exactly.
Highly reflective. And so anybody who says that even we couldn't build something if we attached a fusion engine to it to do what Oumuamua has done is nuts. They're behind the curve.
And of course, you know, to demonstrate that its acceleration close to the sun is almost exactly what you would expect if it had a light sail. And of course, it was performing my favorite maneuver, which is now called, David Brin's the one who named it, a sundiver maneuver.
Ah, yes, yes.
Very close. And, you know, so that made me very...
Although that maneuver is very, very old. Very
old.
Oh,
yes, sure.
I'm trying to remember who first wrote about it. It goes back to classic...
It might be Zandler, because when I first published the papers with Gene Malov on it before Starflight Handbook, this was in 81, 82, and I know Lou Friedman and Chelsea Upwolf had been thinking about it also. There was a Russian team, Elena Polikova at Petersburg. Now it's St. Petersburg again. It's going back to being sanctified. She basically woke me up in her monograph on it, but she also lets me know that Frederick Zandler had mentioned this in the, and he was Georgian, not from where they grow peaches, where they breed vodka instead, from the late 20s or early 30s. So, you know, Jane and I just had updated it, which I'm very glad about. And, but it demonstrates that these ideas have been around a long time. It's like, you know,
indeed, yes.
In their initial studies of extrasolar probes called the Tau mission, NASA talks about powered gravity assists for both the planets and the sun. And I do that with Gene and later with Kelly Parks. And it later turned out that what we should have called it to be accurate is the Oberth maneuver, because Hermann Oberth.
Oh, that's right. That's who I'm. Yes.
In the 1920s.
And for those who have no idea what we're talking about, the idea is that you burn, you know, in a rocket system, you burn your fuel, you turn your engines on at closest approach as you're whipping around a planet or a star. And that gives you an added acceleration using the gravitational assist of the star or planet to go where you want to go. Kind of like a free energy stealing maneuver. But that's not what Oumuamua did. As I've said to you privately, and I'll say now publicly, I think Oumuamua's anomalous acceleration is something so intrinsic to this hyperdimensional physics model having to do with rotation and precession in a gravity field, as demonstrated by De Palma's spinning ball experiment, that has all kinds of other implications for Oumuamua as an object. Because under that model, and I never said this before on the air, under that model, Oumuamua came through the solar system and something disturbed its flight. It was approached, maybe attacked by something that set it tumbling, rotating and precessing, and that's how De Palma measured what he measured on those graphs. So then you have to ask yourself, well, who would have done that? And that opens up the doorway to Vallée and his messengers of deception and who's tried to keep us down on the farm from knowing what's really going on out there and here. And that's a whole series of programs beyond what we have time to get into tonight. But Oumuamua is not a simple story. It's very layered.
No, it's far
and
from
very
it.
Complex.
Yeah.
Let me go back to one of Abby Loeb's ideas, which is the solar sail, which frankly I think is a non-starter. And I want to ask your opinion as a physicist. The two things that ruled out in my mind and in Loeb's mind that this thing was natural were it appeared not to be a cometary object. There was no trace of outgassing. And in a classic cometary model, outgassing changes orbits, et cetera, et cetera. So you have no outgassing, okay? The other one, which is much more rigorous, is from the time it was first observed till the time it disappeared in the largest telescopes like Keck or Cerro Tololo or whatever, the light curve remained constant. The rotation did not change. And any thruster forces, any thrust through, would have to go exactly through the center of mass, either for a cometary object or for a solar sail, to produce acceleration without rotational change. And that's where I think Abby's model of the light sail breaks down, because solar radiation pressure would have changed rotation absolutely in the period of time that we could observe this thing.
So it may be something more complex than that. I've been experiencing something very funny the last 5 minutes. One of our cats, a little long-haired black and white Norwegian forest cat, decided to come up and make love to me and rub against the phone while you were talking, which you may have heard her purring as she's moved off. It was very funny.
We are an equal being opportunity employer here. So cats are welcome. Yes.
So anyway, you know, I've looked at what Avi said, and you may well be correct. I know of two teams who are investigating anomalous propulsion devices, and there may well be something with it. I know Sonny White, who's at NASA, NASA Johnson, I believe, and also Heidi Fern and John Woodward, who are out on the West Coast. I forget exactly where. And they're looking at the EM thruster in the first case and the Mach effect thruster in the second case.
Mm-hmm.
The Mach effect thruster, if it turns out to be right, if it turns out to be correct, would be something that also could do the acceleration.
See, the cool part about the Palma experiment is you don't need an active system. You just need a passive system which has been knocked into a rotation precession state by an exterior force, like an impact, like a shock wave. And see, the coolest part is that Loeb is in a perfect position to duplicate De Palma's experiment, because he's got all of Harvard physics behind him and it got
right.
Grad students. If he does that and photographs it and comes up with the same data, there we are on the threshold of a totally new physics. Does he have the kahunas, Greg, to do this?
Well, he is a very brave man. And what he has done with, and I think it's largely because of his position, the establishment can't hurt him much. So they can go against his grad.
Well, there's a damn Nobel Prize in it if he succeeds, because De Palma, it's so simple. It's so incredibly stupidly simple to duplicate this, and then to duplicate it like in the space station, where you have a large volume in microgravity, zero gravity, and you have two balls and you rotate them. One rotates, one doesn't. They should, according to the model, the theory, they should diverge as the station is orbiting in a closed volume, and you just photograph it. And bingo, you've got new physics and the potential for real space drives.
Yeah.
Will they let him? And will he have the courage to do it if somebody says, don't you dare?
That is a good question. That's a very good question. I think we're going to see, because what you're happening now is you're going public with a lot of stuff.
Yep.
And I think because of that, we're going to see some very interesting developments.
So you want to come along for the ride? As my friend Art used to say, want to take a ride?
I'm very happy to be along for this ride. This is wonderful. This is great. This is great. So,
all right, I have another dumb question to ask. I've been following the Breakthrough Starshot project, and for those people who don't know what it is, describe briefly what the cockamamie fascinating idea these guys have come up with to basically have starflight in our time.
Okay, it comes out of an idea that Bob Forward put forth in the 1985, and he called it Star Wisp. And he said, you take a little tiny nanoprobe, you put it in a microwave beam, and it has to be reflective of microwaves. And you can, even if it's light enough and if the beam is powerful enough, you can project this towards the stars.
By means of radiation
now
pressure,
reflection off the tiny chip. Yuri Milner is one of these people, like Elon Musk, who puts aside the prejudice against billionaires, that all billionaires are evil people, money-grabbing people. No, there are some billionaires who earn their money because they'd like to do something with it.
Yeah, I've actually mentioned Milner on the show several times. He's a kind of an expat Russian oligarch who lives in Northern California, I believe.
Right. He lives in the former Bonds mansion, which is near Palo Alto, overlooking the... you can see the Golden Gate Bridge from it, or the Bay Bridge, I forget which one. But anyway, what he decided to do was put $100 million every year, no, $100 million totally, into listening for extraterrestrials, searching for extraterrestrials, and experimenting on starships. What Breakthrough would like to do, if it's possible, and there's a lot of technical issues, of course, as well as socio-political issues, put together a large laser system, 100 gigawatts.
I'll tell you what, we're coming up to the top of the hour. This is too cool not to go into some decent detail. Then we get to my dumb question. So kind of hold it there. My guest of the morning is Dr. Greg Matloff. We're having a very, very wide-ranging cosmic conversation, and we haven't even gotten to the coolest parts yet, which are, what are the breakthroughs that Webb could give us, and what is this thing about stars being conscious, being sentient entities? I mean, that is just beyond the edge of forever. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment for your endeavors.
$0.08 an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone. Sunday night, Monday morning now here in the Land of Enchantment with a gorgeous gibbous moon out there that we bounced radio signals off of last night, and we got answers. And the next weekend, when we do it again, we're going to actually measure with very fine precision the millisecond delay of the echoes from our transmissions to the moon, and we may have some very interesting things to talk about in terms of what's really on the moon that NASA hasn't wanted to tell you for over 50 years. Anyway, back to our conversation with Greg Matloff. Continue with the Breakthrough Starshot project.
Okay, so we have Bob Forward's initial paper, I believe, in Journal of Spacecraft and Rockets. And along comes Phil Lubin, who's a physicist at University of California. And basically, he updates this somewhat. He says, okay, microwaves will probably roast a spacecraft, but what if you have a very powerful laser, a terrestrial laser, on a mountaintop? If you can keep a sail inside that laser for a sufficiently long period of time, if the reflectivity, if the temperature tolerance is, and if the sail can be shaped appropriately, what happens is you can send it towards the nearest star at low relativistic speed, say as high as 20% the speed of light. And he publishes this in good places.
So it could get to Proxima Centauri in about 20 years.
And what's been going on now, this is called Project Starshot, is people have been investigating the stability of the sail, the type of material you might construct the sail from, the metamaterials, the shape, basically how the laser beam would be shaped, and how the thing would communicate with us if it could. I mean, there's lots of
How big would these little sails that would react to radiation pressure from a laser directed at it through a big telescope on a big mountaintop like Mauna Kea be? How big would the Starshot spacecraft be?
Okay. You are taking something, an energy beam, about 100 times New York City's electrical power requirements, and you're putting it on a sail the size of a piece of paper.
You mean like an 8 by 10, 8.5 by 11?
Roughly like that, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It's an amazing thing. And actually, it turns out that stability is an issue in this. I did take some water. That's okay.
Drink as much as you want.
Fine, I'm fine at the moment. Thank you, though. I will if I have to. If I need. In order to keep it stable, this is something Jim Benford and his brother Greg Benford, the science fiction writer, who's also a physicist,
right,
demonstrated at NASA Marshall in 2000. The sail needs a curvature to stay in a moving beam. And if one end of the beam is on the Earth, the beam will be moving. But if it's accelerating at 5 or 10,000 Earth gravities, how can it possibly have a curvature? It'll collapse to be a flat sheet in a millisecond or less.
Mm.
So what do you do? And what I did, one of the things I did in the year 2000, and we were basically encouraged by Bob Forward to do this. Bob Forward encouraged Les Johnson, or demanded, not encouraged. Bob Forward didn't always encourage.
I ran into Bob at a conference once, and He could be incredible. He was a genius, super genius, but he was incredibly acerbic.
He was.
He made Carl look like a pussycat in terms of ego.
Exactly, exactly. And we come back from a conference in Italy where he had met my wife and discussed message plaques on interstellar spacecraft. She had a show there about it. And we're in the audience, and he's giving a little talk in Huntsville, and he's introduced by Les. And he theatrically points at C, my C Banks, my wife, and says, "Do you see that woman? Do you see her, Les? Fund her to do a holographic prototype interstellar message plaque." And Les quickly revised my little grant to Pace University at the time. So C was able to do a holographic message plaque, and we had all types of fun with it. We wrote a nice, it's been in papers, it's been in books, and some of our 13 books have come now, 13, and you mentioned 9. But basically led to some interesting thought. I'm thinking about breakthrough, and suddenly it hits me. You want to keep something, it has to have a curvature to stay in the sail, but it has to be flat. Or have a hologram of a spherical object. And I almost felt...
Oh, that's genius.
She did a demonstration of this. She came out as an honorary member of Breakthrough, and she showed off the sail. And one of the people there who got very excited about this is Mason Peck. Mason was for many years, he was the chief technologist for NASA at NASA headquarters.
Right.
Now he is a professor of astronautical engineering at Cornell University. And when Mason has put together a team of graduate students and postdocs on something called CubeSat Alpha. And basically, they basically had C with a holographer, an Australian woman named Martina Mongrovius, do a series of 6 holograms. This will be affixed to the CubeSat. This will test, will demonstrate that a holographic or diffractive surface will act in space the way it does on the ground. That
right.
will, for a cost of a few hundred thousand dollars, greatly enhance the technological readiness level of such etched or photographed shapes of space. And it also will have the little chipsats to demonstrate that you can have these little chipsats attached to a sail. And a small sail will also unfurl from the CubeSat. This was supposed to have been launched long ago, but because of COVID, of course, because of COVID, the Cornell campus closes down every couple of months.
Sure.
Just happened again. And this, of course, sets back operations. Other students come in. But currently it's scheduled to be launched by a Falcon 9 and to be unfurled at the space station sometime in May of next year.
Oh, wow.
We'll see if that's scheduled.
Okay.
Well, of course, Omicron might screw that schedule, as Delta and its predecessors screwed the previous schedule. We'll see. Anyway, this has been, I think, my major contribution to Breakthrough at this particular point. And other people have been working on, it doesn't have to be a hologram. There are other ways of getting that type of pattern on it. So it's being called a diffractive sailing, and Grover Schwartzlander at Rochester University, major optics center, has been working with that. And you might also emboss it. If you look at your credit card probably has
mm-hmm.
an embossed hologram. And that's not done
Well, there's a million children's books that use this embossing technology to give the illusion of a hologram.
And I believe it's a lithographic process.
Yeah.
But anyway, it shows that this technology is advancing very, very rapidly. And I'm sure we can solve the sail issues. I'm not so sure about the laser, because a laser that powerful it would have other, I mean, you could do other things.
Well, you can think immediately, weapon.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it can be a good weapon. This is something that I did. I verified something that Phil Lubin and his students and postdocs had published in a number of places. And I think Phil Lubin was the reviewer of the paper because he made sure that I quoted all of his students, which was nice. And basically, you could use this thing to destroy or divert a 500-meter or a 1 kilometer pure iron asteroid on a collision course with Earth.
Oh, now that's
which
a
is
useful.
Amazing.
That's a useful tool. And
so
you could also probably use it to deorbit all the incredibly stupid space junk that, like, the Chinese created by blowing up that weather satellite, and the Russians are claiming that they blew up one of theirs, which I don't believe. I think it's more interesting and complex. But the point is it could literally clear a path back into orbit from all the stupidity of, you know, launching gloves and bolts and flakes of paint and all that stuff. But again, the downside is, in the wrong hands, it becomes a weapon.
So my only thought that might make it happen is you would need two sites on two high mountains, one in the northern hemisphere, one in the southern hemisphere. So have it done as a joint project of the U.S. Space Force and the Russian and Chinese equivalents, and maybe get the Japanese and Europeans.
Yeah, of course, and have everybody watching everybody else. Yeah, why not?
And they watch it, and you use it to launch interstellar or interplanetary probes and to divert.
And defend the Earth against asteroids.
Yeah, to defend the Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could probably even do something with much bigger asteroids if you had more warning, because all you want to do is you basically want to ablate the surface and cause a little nudge, and it doesn't take much of a nudge. That's what DART is supposed to do, to basically make a rendezvous into a non-rendezvous.
Right. Well, I did it. I had a one-year warning time. I forget what Lubin and his students did with warning time, but it has to be around that too. And 1 year, you know, is not unreasonable.
No, not at all. One year is like a brief wink in the history of time. Drink more water. While I set you up to ask my dumb question. When I first heard of the Breakthrough Starshot project, I thought, oh, this is cool. Using lasers and solar sails to accelerate a spacecraft to 20% the speed of light, take about, you know, Proxima Centauri's four some light years away and change. So 20% times five, that's, 20 years. That's within major NASA missions like Cassini was that time frame, or New Horizons is that.
Or Hubble. Yep.
Or Hubble, yeah. Well, I'm thinking of things that go places that have a team.
With a planetary mission.
Yeah. Anyway, so all that was reasonable. Then I started looking, and I started doing a few things on paper with a pencil, and I thought, wait a minute. How the hell, with a little tiny chipset the size of a postage stamp, tugged by a solar sail blown by this laser, when you get to Proxima Centauri, how the hell do you get the data hot?
That is a very good question. And I don't know if I have an answer. Dave Messerschmitt, who I think is the son of the famous fighter plane company, or the grandson probably, has been investigating this with Phil Lubin's team. And, you know, I'm not sure there's an answer. Jeff Landis looked at this, and he doesn't see any way of getting sufficient power into this little thing.
Neither did I. That was a huge showstopper. Yeah. I mean, okay, so you got a little chip sailing past a star at 20% the speed of light. It doesn't do you any good unless you can see what it sees. It's like that old joke, you know, if seeing isn't there to cover it, does a tree falling in the forest make a sound?
Right, exactly. So, you know, I have problems with that too. It's still, people are still playing with the idea, and we'll see what they.
But what are some of the far out ideas that they're looking to get around what seems to be a kind of a fundamental law of physics?
Okay, well, one thing that I did with Les Johnson and decades before that with Al Finley was basically, if you have something like an electrodynamic tether and you deploy it from this thing, you can, if you do it right, you can get energy from the interstellar medium. But of course, how much energy can you get in something that small? You have a payload of maybe a gram. What can you do with that? You know, can you do? And there's something that also that Carl Sagan presented to me once. I gave a talk with Claudio Macone at Cornell in 1992, just the 500th anniversary of Columbus's voyage to the Americas, first voyage, and we talked about sending a sail craft to the sun's gravity focus and using that information to basically greatly amplify astronomical images from the other side, from objects occulted by the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl, who was busy sitting in the first row eating a pastrami sandwich, having a good time with us, said, how long will it take to get your sail out there? And I said, well, with conventional modern day sail designs, I think we can do it in 40 to 60 years. And he said, yeah, this is quite feasible. You could do this, but it will cost a fair amount of development money. At the same time, terrestrial and space-based telescopes will be evolving and developing, and they're much less expensive because they're nearby. And you don't have to maintain this large infrastructure to track the thing. So any information you can get with this, you'll be able to get much faster and much cheaper with something near Earth. And of course, he was right about the economics of it. And I think this is also another problem that you can't, no matter how good you are with nano and pico miniaturization on these chipsats, how much can you put into 1 gram? There will be a limit. And even if you can survive, get around the energy problem, you know, you talk about, okay, maybe we can get a useful photograph. But I guarantee you, in 20 or 30 years, we will be able, maybe even with Webb, who knows, people will be able to have photographs of the surface of Proxima B. And maybe we can detect biosignatures on it. So maybe we should look at Project Starshot as something to advance the technology, but not something that will actually ever fly.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there, because I can envision a very large stabilized array where, you know, basically it's a multi-element interferometer like the Hobby telescope in Texas or whatever. Except it's floating in space. They're little station-keeping separate mirrors, and you can create a huge. Remember, the diffraction limit is the distance apart of the farthest elements of the,
right,
of the mirror.
Right.
So you take two like Hubble Webb-type mirrors. I keep doing that, and you put them a mile apart, and you basically got a telescope with a mile diameter mirror,
right,
and that's going to give you incredible imagery. Provided your mirrors, your floating mirrors, are big enough to get decent signals to noise. So your pastrami eating friend was totally right. It's almost
right,
like the old Heinlein problem, you know, arc ships versus real starships. By the time an arc
right
ship gets to another star, technology and physics will advance to where a warp drive vehicle will pass them in the night and pick them up to take them to have hamburgers on Alpha Centauri.
Right. When you get there, you have to go through customs.
Yes, exactly. And maybe Chinese customs at the rate we're going.
It might well be. So it's, you know, it's a remarkable concept. And also, people used to say, how in the world, this interferometer, could you keep it positioned so closely? Well, with the gravity wave detectors, they do it.
Yeah, it's called laser interferometry.
And
on Earth, we have to evacuate a whole damn tunnel. In space, you don't have to evacuate anything. It's really, really precision station keeping.
Yeah.
And again, there are some breakthroughs. There are some breakthroughs on the horizon that will lead to very, very, very large arrays in space optical resolution or better, and you don't have to go almost anywhere. You stay in the Earth-Moon system. Hey, we got 10 minutes till the bottom of the hour. Let's tackle the big things that Webb is going to blow the doors off, okay?
Okay. One thing it's going to do, I think, is we're going to be able to look back right to the start when stars just begin to turn on.
3.7 billion years ago.
13.7.
Did I say 3? I meant 13. Yeah,
you said 3.
Thank you, thank you.
Just after the cosmic dark age, yep, we'll be able to see the very earliest stars. And that will be interesting, too, because it will be interesting to see how large these things were, because my concept that I play with is that they were very big and they didn't last very long. And they become black holes.
Well, the largest star that I think the Eddington limit, which is radiation pressure in the core, allows is on the order of 100 solar masses. Are we talking
right
stars that are maybe 10 times more massive? 1,000?
I would say more than that, because I think how do the spiral galaxies get million solar mass black holes or billion solar mass black holes
in the center,
in their centers? Something early on had to prepare these black holes. And I think that's one thing we're going to be able to witness.
With Webb.
Do that
with Webb.
With Webb.
Wow.
With Webb. I also think it might be able to, it should do better with imaging extrasolar planets than Hubble has been able to do, or the terrestrial telescopes have been able to do. I think it should, with transiting extrasolar planets, it might be able to pick up biosignatures. I don't know if
no,
we're
wait,
going
you
to be
probably
able to
should,
see.
You probably should explain what you just said, okay?
Okay, when a planet passes in front of a star, what happens is the planet...
You basically get a transit and or an eclipse. The planet...
Right, a transit and or an eclipse, and it affects the light of the star. It also affects the spectrum from the star. Might we be able to detect the spectrum of atomic oxygen, ozone, methane, things like that, that would indicate a living world like we have on the Earth? Now, one thing that people would like to be able to do is, and I'd love to see this, to go to some of the Earth-like planets and see, are there technosignatures? Can we see lights on the planet's surface, the night side of the
ring?
Very large satellites. Can we detect very large satellites, let's say? Things like climate change.
Well, how about industrial rings? Remember Bezos,
who was
basically stealing madly from my old friend Kraft Erica, who said the only proper use for a technological civilization is to put all the industries in space. And save the planet as a living room. So Bezos, multi-billionaire Bezos, has adopted this philosophy as the reason for his Blue Origin mission, and he's talking about transferring industry into space and all that. Well, if you do it big enough and you make an artificial set of rings of industry around the Earth in low or medium Earth orbit, if that planet were translated to the distance of some of the nearer stars, you could literally, with a large enough optical telescope like Webb, see not only the occultation of the artificial rings, but you could maybe pick up the infrared heat emission of the waste heat from all the industry in space.
Right. And also something even larger than that, a sufficiently advanced civilization might do something like construct some stellar-sized object via their sun to maybe reflect light, to transmit energy as a shell, some type of a ring world, as the Larry Niven science fiction. He's also done lately with Greg Benson. He's expanded on that. So,
are you familiar with the weird, bizarre soap opera of Tabby's star?
Yes, yes, yes.
Why don't we have Webb look at Tabby's star?
I think it should. And I think maybe if it could detect a large object near the star but not attached to the star, that would indicate these things exist. There were also in the literature a number of other possible anomalies of the same type, maybe not as dramatic as Tabby Star, but certainly very exciting. And it's not impossible that these could be detected as well and observed as well, and maybe we'd find techno signatures there.
Did you ever have conversations with Freeman Dyson?
I met Freeman Dyson, and I never really got to know him, but I did go to some of his talks. I wish I had.
You mean gotten to know him?
I once asked him a question. Apparently, Star Wisp was originally Freeman's idea, and he did it on the back of an envelope and sent it to Bob Forward, and Bob Forward ran with it. So when he gave a talk once, I told him that was a mighty powerful envelope, and he brushed me off and said, I don't know what you're talking about. I went on to the next question. So he didn't want to talk about Star Wisp, which was okay. I could understand that, because Star Wisp would not have worked.
Right. Okay, let me ask you this question. Dyson is known for the proposal of englobing a star with a huge number of orbital platforms, not a shell, not a beach ball with a sun in the center, but a huge number of orbiting platforms that would basically absorb all the star energy and then utilize it for the local technological civilization. That would reduce the star's optical output and shift it into the infrared, because obviously the energy will get away at some point as infrared. Webb can actually optically detect and image such Dyson spheres if they're out there within some reasonable distance.
One interesting thing also that Dyson did, and I did it in my publications on this, and so has Avi Loeb, call them Stapledon Dyson spheres, because the idea really goes back to Olaf Stapledon's 1937 science fiction story.
Who was, of course, Arthur's lodestar. Arthur took so many of his ideas, publicly acknowledged the huge debt he owed to Olaf Stapledon.
And so has Benson. Benson and Niven have done the same thing. People are doing that now, but the popular scientific press refuses to do that. They continue to call these things Dyson spheres or Dyson shells, even though Dyson corrected them for 20 years and they got tired of it.
Yep.
It's going to be an interesting time.
Okay, we are. I'm falling down the job here. See, I get too caught up in the conversation. My guest this morning is Dr. Greg Matloff. We're having, good grief, a far-ranging discussion that goes light years out there. And we've got a couple more really cool things that Webb can do. And in the last half hour, we're going to talk about Greg's really ingenious idea that stars might be conscious beings in the galaxy. And that brings up shades of Fred Hoyle and the Black Cloud and interstellar communication between whole star systems anyway, we'll get to all that. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. The last half hour you don't want to miss. We shall return.
OtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night, Monday morning, here in the Land of Enchantment. The Other Side of Midnight, my guest this morning, Dr. Greg Matloff, who, as you probably can tell by now, is a fertile creator of some really interesting and cool ideas, and is kind of like what science should be, and too much of the time is not. Populated by people, by beings, by curious conscious entities that simply can think outside the box and ask the most important question, can it be tested? So I think we're kind of done with the Hubble, the web breakthroughs, you know, for how many decades, you know, how many generations have we talked about Hubble? We're going to all have to now think about Webb. Anyway, I can't think of anything we've kind of missed in terms of fundamental shattering breakthroughs that Webb will introduce. Can you?
No, I think, of course, what's going to happen is there'll be a whole series of unanticipated breakthroughs that will freak out everybody, including us, but that's fun. And that will happen.
Well, that's what we want. Yes, yes.
That's exactly what we want.
Yep. Yep. Okay, let's go to your seminal genius level idea. And I'm going to ask another dumb question. Given that they're huge fusion plasma balls, which are kind of at maximum entropy, how the hell can a star be conscious?
Okay, one person who's looked at this initially is Eric Jantsch, J-A-N-T-S-C-H, who was an Austrian physicist who worked at Berkeley. He died in 1981, I suspect of AIDS, but it just called, the web called it a rapid wasting disease. But anyway, he wrote a book called The Self-Organizing Universe, which has become a collector's item. You can get an original copy for $400 or $500 from Amazon today. What I did.
Wasn't there a guy named Prigogine who was also in the same field?
Oh, yes. But I'm trying to remember his book. Yes, there is. But anyway, when I needed for this work the Jantsch book, I looked at the copyright laws and it said if you photocopy a document for your own research work, and you're not doing it for commercial purposes, that is legal. So I went to the CUNY Library, and I saw that both the Graduate Library and the Hunter Library had copies of this book. I took it out, and I then took it to my home computer, and I began scanning. And I probably scanned in 150 of the 200 pages, which is wonderful what he did. And talking about self-organization, he does say that self-organization is a prerequisite for life, for consciousness, for intelligence, what have you. But how could a star, being very, very hot, have this? And he demonstrates that the star itself, the interior of the star, isn't where the consciousness would be. It would be in a thin layer above the chromosphere, and I believe it's called the reversing layer. And that is also where you find molecules. a certain amount of complexity in the cooler stars, including the sun.
Like, well, basically red giants and supergiants.
Well, also M-class stars, G-class stars, K-class stars on the main sequence.
Really? Really? That hot? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. As it turns out, you begin with the, I think, the F8 or the F9 stars was where you first start getting
Here's another dumb question. Can the Parker Solar Probe physically go through this layer?
No.
Oh, okay.
This is the Parker Solar Probe. It has entered the corona already, last I read. And we'll get, this layer is probably just above the photosphere. And the Parker at its closest perihelion, I believe it's going to be 4 solar radii.
Yeah. Okay. So that answers
From the solar center. So it'll be a bit far from it.
So that was a dumb question. Okay.
No, it wasn't. There's no such thing as a dumb question. It will get very interesting data about that. The way I got into this was purely by accident. I got a call from a friend who later has become a co-author, who was then he was editing the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, Kelvin Long, and he sent me an email in 2011 when I was still teaching full-time, and he said, look, we're going to have a one-day symposium on the work of Olaf Stapledon, and would you like to come? And of course, I would love to come, but in the middle of the semester when they schedule it, I couldn't fly over there for 1 or 2 days. So he said he'd be very happy to present my paper. So I was accepted as a person who would be participating in this. And most people, I realize, are going to be writing about the technological projections. There are dozens of them from StarMaker. And I said, you know, I could talk about world ships or arcs or Dyson spheres from now till tomorrow. I want to look at this guy's core metaphysics. And the core metaphysics of Stapledon says that the universe is conscious at some level. And basically what we would today call panpsychism, although I didn't know even how to spell that at the time. And a symptom of this is that a portion of stellar motion is volitional. So I said, okay.
Wait a minute, back up. Say that again carefully.
Okay, the universe, there is a field of consciousness that permeates the universe. And a symptom of this is that a portion of stellar motion, volitional, is non-gravitational.
Meaning they are moving around the galaxy because they want to, not just because of gravity.
Just because of gravity. So, of course, I wanted to find proof or no proof. I would have been happy to go either way.
Would this be an answer to the Rubin mystery? Why galaxies don't appear to be Keplerian objects?
Maybe, but I don't want to. At the time, I didn't want to attack dark matter advocates too much.
Okay.
I figured I'd leave it one step at a time.
Tiptoe so, through the tulips.
Exactly. So I decided I had to do a literature search. Is there any totally strange stellar motions, anomalistic stellar motions, only in the direction of galactic revolution for a star? And I would love to be able to tell you that I went to the 42nd, what used to be the 42nd Street, now 37th Street Research Library, buried myself in 40 years of Acta Astronomica, Soviet Astronomy, App Journal, Astronautical Journal. No. I did something a lot simpler. I went to my computer. I typed in google.com.
Google is your friend.
And then I said, stellar motion anomalies, or stellar kinematic anomalies. And what sprang up was something called Perdenigo's discontinuity. Pavel Perdenigo was a very renowned Soviet Russian astronomer in the 40s and 50s. I believe he died in 1960.
Oh, yeah. He was very famous on those huge O&B-type star clusters.
I believe he did that, too. But he discovered something called Perrenigo's discontinuity. It was confirmed by none other than our old friend Nancy Roman. I learned that later. And what he noticed was cooler stars, F9, G-type, K-type, M-type stars, move a bit faster, about 20 kilometers per second faster around the center of the galaxy than the hotter stars. And where does this discontinuity come in? And it is a sharp dust discontinuity at exactly the same point where people like Otto Struve demonstrated in the 1930s, molecules come in to the spectra of stars. So what does this mean? Well, what would molecules have to do with consciousness? If you look at quantum theories of consciousness, there's a lot of them. Many of them, like my old friend Evan Harris Walker, talked about neuronal consciousness. Maybe you have a wave function of an electron bouncing around between neurons. And when it gets out, you have a thought, or maybe you have ESP, who knows? CIA thought, of course, it was ESP. And then, of course, Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff talk about smaller things than neurons, smaller structures in all living cells called microtubulins.
Mm.
And this demonstrates how even creatures like amoeba seem to have volitional, and slime mold amoeba can apparently make decisions and decide what to do without having a brain, without having neurons. But stars don't have that. On the other hand, these stars have molecules. And one of the quantum consciousness theoretical structures or hypothesis basically says that consciousness comes into the universe through the Casimir effect. And the Casimir effect basically says you have fluctuations in the universal vacuum. They're always bouncing. If you have two thin plates very closely separated, they both have electrical charges, there's more pressure upon them than you would expect. And that is because not all of these fluctuations can fit inside. So the outside fluctuations are pushing it. And Casimir was able to demonstrate this is one of the things that keeps molecules together. So
like an exterior radiation pressure from virtual particles popping into 3D reality from another hyperspatial realm.
Right, exactly. And this goes on. This effect was known to the Romans, in fact, which was amazing. They knew that metal plates tend to stick together. They didn't know why.
Well, there's also this theory, and I forget, Van Flandern was doing a book on this, where gravity is supposed to be an exterior pressure in toward a planet, which kind of like shadows its own self. So the differential forces are greater inward than outward. So you have a gravitational acceleration inward, but it's really a gravitational pressure from outside in toward the core of the planet.
Okay, that's another possibility. But anyway, I moved with this. It was presented. Then I had to have it published. And JBIS gave me, I'm on the scientific board.
The Journal of the British Interplanetary Society.
Yeah. I had to go through four reviewers. I've never had more than two before. And one guy came out and argued with me and said, I'm a materialist. I reject this completely. And I came back to him and said, I'm a materialist too. And you have to let vacuum pressure in as something which influences the material world. So I won the case. I was able to get published. I had to shorten it by a factor of two, which I did. I then put out the original thing on Paul Gilfrey's Centauri Dreams blog. And I began to investigate it further. And I realized that, just what my data had been based upon Hipparchos' data from the early European astrometric satellite. And it goes out to 260 light years. But there is a alternative theory for Perdonego's discontinuity, saying that periodically a dark cloud, a diffuse nebula, a stellar nursery, whatever you want to call it, passes through our galactic vicinity. And because it is higher density than the surrounding galactic medium, interstellar medium rather, it drags the less massive stars along. This is called spiral arms density.
Oh, range. I was just going to ask you, is that the spiral arms density curve thing?
Right. And it's a nice theory, except it's wrong. And the reason it's wrong is these people, it was another indication that there's a lot of people, a lot of astrophysicists who never look at the sky. They spend all their time on computers.
Mm-hmm.
I went three star catalogs. I have the Messier at home. I have the Herschel at home for deep sky objects. I was able to get the new General Survey, NGS, I think it is, online.
NGC, I think.
NGC, new General Catalog. And I looked for, I knew that the Hipparchus data was good out to 260 light years. How big are these objects? Well, there was only one of the known diffuse nebula larger than 500 light years across. And that is called 30 de Radio, or the Tarantula Nebula, which is in the larger Magellanic Cloud, a satellite to the Milky Way. And, okay, so I couldn't, with the data that was then there, disprove density waves. It looked pretty good, because if there's only one, the chances of that coming through our neighborhood is pretty remote.
So I had to wait for Gaia.
Yes. And in 2015, when after Gaia had been launched, I was at a conference in Turin where they were analyzing the Gaia information. I tried to get in, and they knew I was there. They basically blocked the door.
Oh.
Said, you have to be patient. You must wait. I contacted another person who had done work on Perdonego's discontinuity, Richard Branham in Argentina. And he got back with a three-word email response, patience,
Prudence.
And then in 2018, along came the paper that I sent you from the wonderful group in St. Petersburg. And they basically validate Perdonego's discontinuity out to 1,000 light years or more, which, of course, put me into seventh heaven.
But for one thing, it's 16 times the volume of space.
Yeah. So it really demonstrates that this is a non-local or a galactic phenomenon, which made me very, very happy. But then there was something else. There was a peculiar bump in both the Hipparchus data and the Gaia data. And the bump is basically between a GO star going out to figure an F8 or an F9, K8 or K9. And if you read the paper, it talks about that. You can see the bump. If you look up Perdonego's discontinuity online, it will probably come up. If you look up images, my technical drawing of this, you can see that bump very distinctly.
When you say bump, you're now talking about a kind of an aberration in the velocity anomaly, right?
It is, you know, it's like all of a sudden it goes up and then it goes down again. And I had ignored it. I said, maybe it's just something with the
Maybe we should call it a spike as opposed to a bump.
I could call it a spike. That's a good. But the St. Petersburg team, Vitievsky, I think is his name, and his colleagues had a lot more stars to deal with. They had, instead of 10,000, they had more than 1,000,000.
Wow.
And what they learned is the stars, as they age, speed up in their revolution velocity around the galaxy. And this was amazing. So I went online again with Paul Gilster's blog. We talked about this. And I said, maybe this also is another validation to stellar consciousness. But some of the very clever blog responders said, maybe so, but maybe it also is the product of an advanced galactic civilization that's all around us. And I couldn't rule that out.
Now, that's an interesting idea.
So I contacted
A third one to confuse your poor life already. Maybe it's a product of a different physics. I go back to the ball because...
Maybe so.
But see, Avi Loeb can test that. So simple,
maybe,
so,
yeah, maybe
so
he's
cheap.
The one, maybe he'll be the one to do it. That'll be interesting.
Well, wait a minute. Wait. You happen to work at a university. Why don't you test it?
Well, our university doesn't really have very many experimental labs at this point. At City Tech, is mostly theory, and it's largely because of space.
Right.
It'll be the big, and you know, it will be the big research universities where this test will be made. But anyway, I put together a research team with Roman Kesavitsavalli of Georgian descent, who teaches at the college with me, and or he's a fundamental physicist. And Kelvin Long in the UK, who had some ideas, we got a paper out after some aggravation in JBIS in which we pointed out eight possible modes that a star could accelerate. And the standard physics modes don't work. The ones that work better require either a hypercivilization or a sentient star. And so I published something recently with Roman. Kelvin was working on a PhD program, so he didn't want to get involved with this paper, in the Journal of Consciousness Exploration and Research. This is my latest publication, just came out. And what we really talk about there is what this is going to mean for the physics paradigm, because if future work reveals that stellar acceleration is real, and if normal physics doesn't handle it, and if we don't come up with some new physics pretty quickly, we're going to have to accept either aliens all over the place and all around us, or smart stars.
And then we're into Ball's hypothesis, which he published in American Scientist decades ago, which was called the zoo hypothesis. It's the reason we don't interact with these guys is that we're in quarantine.
We might be, or it might be that rather than being in quarantine, they don't. It may be that organic life, about type of life, is kind of rare, and they want us to be able to evolve as far as we can on our own. And of course, maybe with a little directed
so
help from them.
We're talking Roddenberry's prime directive.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I have another dumb question. We only have about 6 minutes, so I want to get my dumb questions in. If let's say the sun is one of these, it's a G-type star, and for people who don't follow these letters, the cooler the star, the farther out in the alphabet it goes. So it's G is yellow, K is orange, M is red. So the temperature goes down and the mass goes down as you get further out in the alphabet. Okay. So a G-type star, a sun is a G-type star. Let's assume it's got consciousness. How does it interact with our consciousness on either Earth alone or in a previously inhabited epoch when, you know, we were all over the solar system with colonies and cities and, you know, habitats and whatever? In other words, how does a star interact with other consciousness in its own system?
That's a good question. I know two people who've been working with this. One is Clement Vidal, who is a Belgian natural philosopher. I almost said national philosopher, but natural philosopher. He does also a lot of work with SETI. And Clement has demonstrated that at least one class of stars, the parasitic binaries, where one star is eating another one, mm-hmm. and he calls them stellivores, satisfy 18 of the 20 requirements for living organisms. He put this out on Acta Astronautica, wrote a book about it.
Oh.
Yeah. If you remind me by email, I can send you a copy of this paper. Please email me for stellivores, Clement Vidal. The other person...
Stellivores as opposed to carnivores.
Carnivores, exactly. Send me an email. I'll be happy to send that to you. Not too early tomorrow morning, but this morning.
Okay. Right, yes.
But I will get it out. The other person is Rupert Sheldrake, who is a very controversial British biologist.
You think? Rupert published a brilliant paper, which you can't find anywhere now on the web, where he actually has measured differences of the speed of light, mainstream measurable differences, and they banished the paper.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. I may have to ask him for a copy of that paper.
Yeah, have him send one to me, too, please.
I will. Okay, now, but Rupert, when he was doing his postdoc, he organized an agricultural research station in Hyderabad, India. So he became very fascinated by Hinduism. And there is a sun salute, a salute to the sun, which is regularly done, and it's done in yoga as well. So he saw that the sun as a conscious entity is very much part of Hindu thought. And he sat on this for years. Then along came my paper, and he'd like to do a little experiment. And a little experiment is you come up with an appropriate sunspot orientation. You broadcast this in the direction of the sun, maybe by radio. You have a lot of sufficiently talented people meditating on it.
You mean you send
and
it like a pictogram?
Yeah, and you see if the sun will reproduce that to communicate with us.
Oh.
And it's an interesting idea. It would be if it can be done. And, of course, the problem with it, and he knows, is, you know, he would probably have to come up with this pictogram and then have to find an appropriate source to keep it with. But it would have to demonstrate that he or his group came up with it first, and then later on reveal the appropriate date,
Greg,
what the correlation is.
Greg, we've run out of runway.
But I've run out of voice.
We have to do this again. This was so much fun. My guest this morning was Dr. Greg Matloff, absolute entrepreneur and astrophysicist and out-of-the-box thinker. Remember, next weekend, our Christmas weekend, the transmissions to Oumuamua and the moon, be there or be square. We'll do it on Christmas Eve. You won't hear that one. We'll give you the results on Christmas night and the night after Christmas. And until then, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night. Okay, we are clear.
Well, that was definitely a fun show.
Greg, are you there? Did we lose him?
I don't. Yeah, he's gone.
Oh,
told him to stick around.
Yeah, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, he did wonderful. He just needs to drink more water. He's dehydrated. So.
Okay.
Oh, that was wonderful. Yes. That was a lot of fun. And it set things up perfectly for... You know, if Abby Lowe doesn't get this message, it will never get to him. Okay, so you're going to send Kintia the file. You and I are going to talk tomorrow. Kintia, you and I will, I don't know whether I'll call you after I talk with this guy or I'll wait till, you know, later in the evening. I'm probably even going to want to do a couple other things. I have to get some food in here, so my day is chopped up.
Okay.
What was that, Keith?